That was a good start. This podcast of Word of Mouth is supported in part by Doucette Survey.
Nice.
Doucette Survey, serving your professional land surveying mapping needs in New England, now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine.
There's more information at doucetsurvey.com. We could do it like robots.
Word of Mouth Daily Podcast, sponsored by Doucette Survey.
Word of Mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Taylor Quimby, sitting in for Virginia Prescott. When words or phrases enter the popular lexicon, constant use sometimes alters their meaning, and not always for the best.
All Republicans know that we must pass immigration reform in order to...
Myanmar's political reforms are not happening.
With common sense tort reform to protect our physicians from...
Hatred of the health care reform from the right
wing. What's changed is an opportunity to actually see real reform get demanded.
Eric Zorn is an op-ed columnist and daily blogger for the Chicago Tribune. He says journalists have gotten into the bad habit of misusing the word reform or reformer. He recently joined Virginia to make his case.
So talk a little bit about the literal, the true meaning of reform versus how you think it's being used by journalists today.
Well, I mean, obviously, literally, to reform something only means to change it, right? But ever since the Reformation, hundreds of years ago, the sense of reform is to improve something. Like you send a kid to reform school and to change him, make him for the better. And think of all the, when you speak of a reformed alcoholic or a reformed drug addict or a reformed criminal, they're all improved. And so, literally now, the meaning, the first meanings in the dictionary of the word reform is change for the better. And that's fine. If you are advocating for immigration reform and you're an immigration rights advocate, then clearly you believe that the changes that you're promoting are going to be good. But when journalists are using this word kind of casually, when they're talking about any kind of reform, and we're talking about all these changes in the law that are proposed, again, you hear expressions, tort reform, medical malpractice reform, healthcare reform also is the big one. I mean, it's to speak of Obamacare as a healthcare reform law. Now, no matter how you feel about Obamacare, to call it healthcare reform is to say that it has improved the healthcare system.
Mm-hmm.
And it may have, but your words are actually making that point. You are using loaded language, and I think most journalists who use it don't really mean it that way. I think they just say, oh, well, this is just shorthand, but we have to avoid that word if we want to maintain some sort of appearance of neutrality. And even a columnist like myself who has opinions about all kinds of things, I feel like to use that word is lazy. I mean, I think we should all avoid it and stop sprinkling it into our language as though everyone agrees that the changes that are proposed are good changes.
You're talking about pundits. You're talking about other journalists. How about you? Are there examples of you turning to this word that you call lazy?
I am a serial abuser of the word reform, and this is I became sort of aware of this when someone pointed it out to me on Facebook. And I went and looked at my clips, and I've used it 400 times or more in this casual way. And just recently, earlier this month, I referred to the pension reform law in Illinois, and I referred to our governor who just lost his election as a reformer. And this was just my lazy shorthand. So I'm as guilty as the next person of abusing this word.
What is another word that could be used instead?
Well, I talked to the Associated Press about this, and they have the same sort of feeling about the word. They urge journalists to avoid it, and they talk about words like overhaul or revision, a revamping of something or change. That you want to use words that just suggest this is going to change the way things are, and you leave it up to the people on both sides of the debate to make the argument that it's better or worse. I mean, here in Illinois, there's lots going on about the pension laws, and the people who are opposed to the law that just passed here call it pension deform. The people who are in favor of it call it pension reform. And I think that there's no need for journalists to get into that kind of name-calling and nomenclature. We need to just say it's a pension overhaul. It's a pension revision.
Yeah, but once you use it, that's how everybody understands it. So if you start talking about pension overhaul, will people still get it?
I think they will. I think people are smart enough to get that, yes. And, you see this also in things like when people talk about pro-life and pro-choice. And many journalists have made a decision to avoid those terms in their reporting to, if to describe someone as pro-life or pro-choice, because those terms themselves are you know, tendentious, one can argue. And that, so the best thing to do is to try to use as neutral a language as possible, especially if you're trying to project an objective tone.
All right, Derek Zorin, time to reform, or can I not use that term anymore?
I'm a reformed reform user.
That was Eric Zorin chatting with Virginia Prescott. Eric Zorin is an op-ed columnist and daily blogger for the Chicago Tribune. You can read his case against the word reform. There's a link at wordofmouthradio.org. And up next on Word of Mouth, Cory Doctorow shares his thoughts on how artists can make it in the digital age. Stick around. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Taylor Quimby, sitting in for Virginia Prescott. In the pre-internet, pre-digital world, if you wanted to get your art into the hands of would-be fans, you had to pound the pavement, spend a fortune on marketing, or just be the recipient of good old-fashioned dumb luck. Our hyper-connected digital world gives the illusion that being an artist and making a living wage by selling the work you create has become easier. Open an online store to sell your art, self-publish your novel, upload your original song to YouTube, and watch the checks roll in, right? Well, you're still going to need that dumb luck. But as our next guest insists, you'll also need an understanding of how the online world works. Cory Doctorow is a science fiction author as well as the co-editor of Boing Boing. His most recent book is Information Doesn't Want to Be Free: Laws for the Internet Age. Virginia talked to Cory about making money as an artist, the role that copying plays in contemporary art, and corporate power. She started by asking him about the fine line between companies like Apple, who want to protect their software, and straight-up censorship.
Well, I don't think it's a fine line at all. I think that they're indistinguishable, that when you set up a system, for example, the takedown system that we have for copyright infringement on the Internet, at the entertainment industry's behest, the 1998 Digital Millennium Copyright Act, or DMCA, specifies that if you host material for other people, whether you're Facebook or a university website provider or Google, that on receipt of a notice that says this infringes my copyright or someone whom I represent, that you're really obliged to just remove that material. And there's no adversarial judicial process. There's no due process. And if you abuse that, if you send a frivolous takedown, there's not really any penalties that you pay. So when you create a totally unaccountable system of censorship orders, it would be really naive to expect that you wouldn't get totally unaccountable abuse of censorship. And in addition to the entertainment industry using it and sometimes abusing it, for example, Fox, the broadcaster, took down legitimate copies of my book, Homeland, because they have a mediocre television show by the same name. They just didn't even bother to look before they sent censorship orders, theoretically on penalty of perjury, but with no effective penalties for breaking it. But it's also bad for people who just are trying to have conversation.
Well, this book is not a guide for creative people to obtain fame and fortune as an artist. In fact, you make it pretty clear that the odds are kind of stacked against people who choose to pursue a creative career. Well, who then is this book for?
Well, actually, let me mildly disagree with you here. It is a guide to how to make sure that if your art is making money, that as much of that money goes to you as possible. It's not a guide to how to make money, but what we really need to be sure of is that whatever money there is in the system, that it goes preferentially to artists, and then to their investors, the publishers and studios and labels, and then finally to the providers, the people who get the work out to the audiences, like Google and YouTube and Amazon and Apple. And right now, in the name of protecting the interests of artists and their investors, we've got the system just backwards.
But despite all these challenges for artists, you do hold to some of the most important things that one needs to do in order to have a career as a, let's call them, content maker, you know, musician, a writer, an artist, a photographer. That's persistence, that's talent, and a grounding in how the online world works. Now, what kind of grounding? Where do we begin?
I think you have to start from the Realpolitik of the Internet, which is that copying is never going to get any harder. So you may start with the position that in your ideal world, only people who paid you would ever get to see your stuff. But the reality is that there's no future on our horizon in which it will be harder to get your stuff without paying for it than it is today. All you can do in the face of that incontrovertible fact is try to work out ways to accommodate it. Now, you may try to maximize the amount of money people give you, the amount of people who pay, by trying to frighten people into not getting it for free. That's been the major entertainment industry effort so far. Or you may try to entice them, whether that's by offering a good deal at a price that people are willing to pay, or by doing what I've done historically, which is release my books under Creative Commons licenses at the same time as they're published by major publishers. And then by performing this public act of generosity, inviting a reciprocal act from my audience, which is, to my mind, something that is really also artistically satisfying, that connection between the artist and audience is a very good one.
Well, you make that point that if you give it away, people will eventually come to know it. They will come to know you and eventually pay. But does that work for all creative pursuits, say photography, say a jeweler? How do they give away their work in order to become internet famous, quote unquote?
Well, I certainly don't think that if you give it away, they will automatically pay. I just think that unless people have heard of you, they'll never give you any money. So there are lots of ways to become heard of, but it's a fantasy to expect that people who've never heard of you and don't know that your work exists will ever pay you for it. So you need to have some strategy by which people who love your work can promote it, and people who might love your work can come into contact with it. And almost everything that almost everyone has ever done to make money in the arts has failed. And so, absolutely, this strategy will not work for everyone. In fact, no strategy will work for almost everyone. Almost everyone who ever will set out to make money in the arts will lose money in the arts for reasons that have nothing to do with the internet.
Well, I read in the introduction, there are two introductions, Neil Gaiman and his wife, actually, Amanda Palmer, both write a little essay for you. Amanda Palmer says, copy, 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 copy. Is this the So what does embracing copying mean for the individual artist?
Well, you know, in the 21st century, anything that people love will be copied. Again, that's a fact and not really a problem. It's just a thing that's true. So you can make art that's not contemporary. You can make retro art. You know, if you want to be like the blacksmith at a pioneer village, that's totally awesome. As a science fiction writer, though, I really feel like my work should at least be contemporary, if not futuristic, and making work that's intended to be copied. So, for example, works that have licenses that allow free sharing, works that are come with decomposable elements that can be incorporated into other works, whether that's so in this book, for example, it constitutes one very long argument, but each sub-argument of it is laid out on a single page that can be readily copied and sort of stuck up in your cubicle or posted on your wall or made into a SIG file or put on your Facebook post or whatever. Making things that are intended to be copied is really making them 21st century works.
I want to get to Neil Gaiman's point, something that he wrote in his essay, you know, that he has embraced the live audience model. He has embraced Twitter. But some people can't or won't or don't work their stuff on the internet. Are those people just going to be left behind?
Well, you know, it is true that different technological moments have afforded incomes to different kinds of creators. You know, before the radio and the record came along, nobody really even suspected that there was such a thing as a great performer who didn't like performing in front of people. Like it was a contradiction in terms. Right. And the rise of the recording and radio created this market that eventually eclipsed the live performance market. And at the time, the people who were being effectively forced off stage by the dwindling market for live performance that was being outcompeted by the recorded performance, those people said, "What do you mean you want me to go into a studio? I'm a performer who does something as old and as holy as the first story told in front of the first fire. You have no business telling me how to earn my living." And then, you know, 70 years later, the musicians who are the kind of spiritual descendants of the ones who put those performers out of business, the studio musicians, say, "What do you mean you want me out there on the stage? I'm not a trained monkey. I'm a white-collar worker. I work indoors, you know, with my muse, and when I'm done, I slide the product of my work under the door, and some bourgeois man of commerce takes it out to the unwashed, right? You have no right telling me I have to go on the road." Technology giveth and technology taketh away. And so I think that what we should be concerned with as people who love the arts and who want to make sure that artists are compensated is not choosing which artists get compensated, but by making sure that whatever mode of artistic production is successful in this moment, that the rules around it favor the artist as the most favored nation for receiving the money from it, their investors secondarily, and the platforms last.
We're talking with Cory Doctorow, who is, among other things, the author of Information Doesn't Want to Be Free. It's a book about the pitfalls and the opportunities and creative industries and individuals are confronting today, and about how the old models have failed or are finding new footing. Well, you've come up with some ideas or looked at models of how artists who are giving their content away, quote unquote, can make money. What are some of those ways?
You either sell tickets, so you perform, or you make a physical embodiment of your work, whether that's a book or a CD or whatever, and you sell that at a price that people are willing to pay. Or you sell things that are kind of around your object. So you do things like sell T-shirts or sell models or sell souvenirs or tchotchkes of some description. You take commissions. So people like Jonathan Coulton, who's this, you know, beloved nerd troubadour who produces music independently, then gets commissioned to write anthems for immensely popular video games like Portal that, you know, pay off his mortgage. Or you you solicit voluntary contributions. Sometimes people have done that on the front end with things like Humble Bundle, where people choose their own price for independently produced media. Now on the back end through crowdfunding platforms like Kickstarter. While the technicalities are different, this is not massively different to how artists have earned their living all along.
Talk about your ideas for the blanket license, one of the things that you mentioned in your book, which we are familiar with in the radio industry. We used to have a license to play everybody's music and they would get paid individually. Explain what you mean by it and how it would work for consumers and artists.
Sure. Well, you know, as you mentioned, when it stopped being possible or plausible to control the uses of music because people were playing live music in bars, they were playing covers, or they were playing jukeboxes, there were huge regulatory fights about this. There was the first version of home taping is killing music, this massive, ugly fight. And the way that this all got resolved was through a combination of law and policy. We created these blanket licenses where the person who operates the commercial entity where the consumption is happening pays a reasonable amount of money, and reasonable in this case means that you get most people complying with it for less than it would cost you to send police around to make sure that they're complying with it. That's kind of how you know when you've got the right number, right, where your enforcement costs drop below your profit. There is some kind of statistical sampling of what is being performed. And then the rights holders to that work get compensated. So you could think of this as the moral right to choose who can perform your work gets converted to the economic right to just get compensated when your work is done. And that you know, covers covers as well. So, you know, when Sid Vicious recorded My Way, Paul Anka didn't get to tell him yes or no. He just got sent a check, right? You know, there are lots of problems with this, but we can make that better. We could say that if you're operating an internet service provider, and you choose to buy the blanket license for your audience, you would pay, whatever, $5 a month, which is a hell of a lot more than the average American is spending every month on music right now. You pay $5 a month per customer, and you could advertise, sign up with my ISP. It comes with all the music ever recorded. And then we would create a collecting society, and it would have the organizational and analytic acumen of something like Google, and it would do good statistical sampling, statistically valid statistical sampling, to figure out whom to pay what proportion of that money that was collected. Again, that would be an imperfect system, but it's a lot less imperfect than stamping your foot in frustration and demanding that the internet be made worse at copying.
Cory Doctorow, do you have a worst fear or kind of nightmare scenario for the future if we don't figure this out for artists, for creative content makers?
Funny you should mention. Yeah, I mean, and that's going back to that third law that information doesn't want to be free, but people do. It's that not what happens to the arts, although what happens to the arts if we get this stuff wrong is that the money that's being generated by the arts goes to people who don't deserve it. But the real issue is what happens to our world, because we live in a world that is effectively made out of computers. We have buildings where the most important fact about them is the computer and the thermostat, because if that computer is compromised, then the house becomes uninhabitable. Cars are computers that whip you down the road at 80 miles an hour, and we've seen attacks on them where their Bluetooth can be compromised and their steering and brakes be taken over. And so in this world made of computers, we really want to be sure that the security model for those computers is that if someone finds a flaw in those computers, they can let the people who depend on those computers know about it. So they can either change vendors, they can figure out who they want to buy from and buy from people who make the most secure products, or demand that their vendor secure it, or take some other step to mitigate it, right? If you know that your brakes aren't working as well as they should be, you can drive more slowly and carefully. If you don't know that your brakes don't work, well, you'll find out the hard way. And right now, the rules that we have for our devices are that if there's a flaw in your device, you can't know about it because it might allow you to jailbreak the device and break the copy protection. And so it's a felony to tell you about the flaws in your devices. And so we have to denorm this. We have to change the idea that it is right and proportional or ever justified to design computers whose default posture isn't yes, master, but I can't let you do that, Dave.
Well, what a vision. And Cory Doctorow, I want to thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you very much. It was a lovely chat.
Virginia Prescott there, talking with Cory Doctorow about his most recent book, Information Doesn't Want to Be Free, Laws for the Internet Age. Now, while Cory Doctorow argues that artists shouldn't be too concerned about others duplicating their work, copying currency is a federal offense. We explore the art and the folly of counterfeiting cash when Word of Mouth returns.
Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Taylor Quimby, sitting in for Virginia Prescott. Some crimes are born out of sheer desperation, some out of rage, and others out of passion. But this next crime we're about to share with you was born out of love. The podcast Criminal brings us this story of love and counterfeit.
So he was about 6'3", 6'4", kind of lanky, but played basketball, so muscular, like huge nose, big lips.
This is Maya, and when she was 19, she was infatuated with a guy named Adam. These names aren't real. We're using fake names for reasons that'll become apparent later.
Just kind of hit all my personal buttons in a way that, honestly, very few people have since then. It was almost as if he was my physical ideal. And I actually remember seeing him for the first time my freshman year and really feeling like my breath had been taken away.
When you're infatuated with someone, you can convince yourself of a lot of things, like who they are and what they're capable of. And Maya was infatuated.
I had this feeling of really not being able to believe that I was allowed to physically touch this person.
But just because you can touch something doesn't mean it's real. I'm Phoebe Judge, and this is Criminal.
So our first date was actually pretty hilarious. I'm not sure exactly how it was arranged, but I was very, very, very excited about it for multiple reasons. One, that I was just physically kind of putty when I looked at him even, but also because he lived in Brooklyn. And so we both went to NYU, but he and I lived in the dorms in the city, and he had an apartment in Brooklyn. And I think I'd been to Brooklyn once. So that night we actually went to a magazine party because he had worked at a magazine briefly before school. So I was at this very sophisticated party, and people were very much in love with him there, and women were all over him there the way they were everywhere. But it was definitely an older crowd. I mean, we must have been 19, and everyone was probably in their late 20s. And I got completely hammered, like so faced that I think he actually had to carry me back to his apartment, which was, of course, mortifying. So we went back to his apartment. He put on some D'Angelo. I think he smoked weed, or we both smoked some weed. And I was like, this is actual heaven. Like, this is my understanding of what heaven is. But then nothing could really happen because I basically blacked out. The next day I woke up and there were, you know, like blunt papers kind of all over the floor and this and that. And he was like, yeah, you passed out. So I basically just smoked weed and like listened to music. And I was really embarrassed. And then so we started our trek back to the city. I wasn't really sure how to get home. And we got our kind of the standard bacon, egg and cheeses. And I think I got a coffee and he got a Snapple. And we went to the train station and he swiped me in on his Metro card and then jumped the turnstile. Immediately a plainclothes police officer started chasing him. So I was stuck holding his breakfast while he takes off like a bolt of lightning and is literally being chased around by a cop. I see him hiding behind a trash can. I see the cop running up a flight of stairs. And I just got on the train and went back to my dorm with his breakfast and my own. And he finally called me either that night or the next morning and just tried to play it off.
And she let him. It didn't seem like that big of a deal. It was kind of a funny story. So while it's not the typical foundation for a successful relationship, they ended up going out again and again. They dated for a couple of years. But slowly, Maya started to notice other little things. Like he told her he grew up in the Bronx when he was actually from New Jersey. He was always borrowing things from people, asking for favors, and he managed to almost never spend money.
His whole thing was figuring out how to live with nothing. So at two points when we lived together, we lived for free. He had this incredible way of talking his way into kind of people's homes and then saying he would do something for them. And he just, I've never seen anything like it. He would just get away with not paying rent.
They graduated from college. Maya was taking acting classes. Adam wasn't working. And those little things, the lies and the mysterious ways in which Adam always got his way, began to escalate.
One of the biggest things he did was steal a projector from a hotel that he was just kind of walking through randomly, and he found a conference room with a really fancy projector and just walked out with it and was very excited because it was something like $10,000 and he didn't know if he wanted it or if he wanted to sell it. I got really upset and he basically bullied me into saying, you know, this corporation or these people have so much money, they're stupid for leaving it out and I need it and I want it and I took it. It was there.
So he's doing all of these things. You kind of know about him, what he's doing. Did you ever help him?
Well, I didn't help him until we started counterfeiting money.
So how did that, what do you mean until you started counterfeiting money?
Well, one day I came home to the apartment we were living in, again, living in for free. And he very proudly showed me a $20 bill. And I said, where did this come from? And he explained that he had this color printer and he had spent the entire day scanning and then, you know, kind of lining up copies of $20 bills so that he could create something that was two-sided. And actually, it looked pretty decent. And he went through a period of kind of trying to find the right color and finding the right paper. Because, you know, now bills feel and are very slick. They're very hard to kind of wear down. But back then, you could still have kind of a nubbly or very rough-feeling bill.
Wait a second. It seems to me like you need more than just like a color printer to counterfeit money or like just some special paper. I mean, isn't that what like there are thousands of people that just spend their whole lives trying to make sure that you can't just buy a color printer and start printing hundreds?
It was child's play, kind of. I mean, it couldn't have been a more basic and kind of pathetic operation. I mean, it was two kids in their 20s. You know, f***ing around in Brooklyn. And it worked.
How long did it take him to convince you to actually use the money? Do you remember the first time it really left the house?
It did not take long. The first time we went out, we did discuss it, and I think we tried it once or twice at a deli, and it didn't work.
I mean, what do you mean it didn't work?
So they would just say, this is fake.
Were you mortified? Like, I would pretend to be like, are you kidding me? I got ripped off? Like,
I had a whole song and dance every time I got caught. Like, are you kidding? What am I supposed to do? How did this happen? I can't believe this. Oh my gosh, I'm so sorry. And it was kind of through these like pathetic little plays that we'd put on that we realized that people were much nicer to me if I was the one who did it and got caught. They just kind of treated me like a stupid little girl, but would actually get much angrier at him. So what we figured out then was that we wouldn't be successful if we were doing it at a place where people had the opportunity to pay a lot of attention to the money that we were handing them. So any place like a well-lit bodega or a supermarket wasn't going to fly. So we quickly realized that we needed to do it at bars, places where bartenders were busy, places where it was dark and people were distracted. And what we were doing, we weren't interested in drinking or partying. We were just interested in getting the change. So, you know, $6 beer, $14 back, and you pocket that. And maybe drink part of the drink and leave. So one of the first places we went, I got caught and I, you know, performed my little performance. And I remember very distinctly the bartender saying, "I'm going to choose to believe your lie, but this isn't real and you need to get out of the bar." And I kind of skedaddled and freaked out. I made my boyfriend drop the next bill. That's what we called it, dropping bills, at another bar. And it was actually a female bartender. And she flipped out and chased him out of the bar and said she was going to call the cops. And he was laughing, but he was terrified. And that's where we really realized that I was the person who was going to be most successful.
Maya didn't realize this at the time, but she and Adam were part of a trend. Lots of young people were getting printers and making their own money. In 2000, 40% of all counterfeited money, about $72 million, came off of inkjet printers. It's a big deal. Counterfeiting is a federal crime investigated by the Secret Service. If you get caught, you're facing up to 15 years in prison and massive fines.
I don't think we ever hit up more than six places in an evening. But inevitably during those nights, someone would stop me somewhere. I remember we were on a good streak and then I had to go to this one bar. And these were all bars that I liked and had gone to previously. And this bar had a bouncer out there that particular night. And there was a cover charge and I tried to pass off a bill to him. And he said that it wasn't real. And I was a little bit drunk at that point. So I did my whole song and dance. And I kind of sensed that he knew that I was full of but he, again, just kind of let me wander away.
And did you ever go home after, like, you know, the night where the bartender said, "I'm going to choose to believe you"? Would you go home at night and say to him, "This is nuts. Like, why are we doing this? This is not worth it"?
I do not remember ever doing that. I think I didn't have the because I think that he thought it was really fun. And I thought it was a little bit fun myself. The final time that I was caught was so bad that that's what made us stop. But it took getting that close to being in serious trouble for the rest of my life for me to kind of snap to it.
Do you think of yourself as a criminal?
I don't.
Why?
I think I must. I'm not sure why. So this is, I've never really considered this before, but I didn't. Even though I did have criminal intentions, you know, I wanted this money, I wasn't trying to hurt anyone and don't feel that I particularly hurt anyone. Although certainly, I guess, it's possible that if a bartender was caught, you know, if they were caught with a counterfeit bill in their cash register, that they could get fired. And that's totally possible. But to me, it was so stupid and has kind of become a bit more fun in retrospect. It's become both more fun and much more embarrassing in retrospect. You know, it's a great story to tell at a party because I wasn't caught.
And how long did you and Adam last after this incident?
Not long.
Maya left New York. She went to California to try to get Adam out of her life forever, which was hard because as much as she was scared of what he could make her do, she was still just as fascinated with him as she was from the start. It's been more than 15 years, but as far as she remembers, they only profited about $400. And frankly, she doesn't know what they did with it. She does know they didn't spend it on anything nice, because Adam was so cheap. The show is produced by Eric Mennel, Lauren Spohr, and me. Julianne Alexander does our episode art. If you like what we're doing, you can subscribe on iTunes or visit our website, thisiscriminal.com. We're on Twitter, at Criminal Show. I'm Phoebe Judge, and this is Criminal.
That story came to us from the really wonderful podcast, Criminal. You'll find a link to the full audio from that episode, including the story of how she almost got caught. That's at wordofmouthradio.org. Over the last 100 years, they've been bought, sold, cherished, and burned. Up next, the history of the bra, from Jane Russell to Madonna. That's when Word of Mouth continues. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Taylor Quimby, sitting in for Virginia Prescott. 100 years ago this month, the United Kingdom, France, and the Russian Empire declared war on the Ottoman Empire. America's midterm elections brought a 4-seat gain for Senate Democrats, Republicans won 63 House seats, and the United States issued a patent for the first modern bra. In the ensuing century, the brassiere has been put on and taken off without fanfare by millions of women the world over, save a few notables like Jane Russell, Janet Leigh in Psycho, Madonna, or famously not worn by Gloria Steinem and others in the women's lib movement of the late 1960s. To find out more about the significance of this typically hidden item, Virginia chatted with Lynn Burady, associate professor and chair of fashion and textile technology at SUNY Buffalo.
Lynn, welcome to Word of Mouth.
No, thank you, Virginia.
Tell us about the origin of the bra.
Well, actually, we see images of a bra-like garment dating back hundreds of years. But the more modern bra came out of almost a rebellion of wearing the corset, which was extremely tight, uncomfortable to wear, and women would loosen the corsets when they were home. And so the inventor of the modern brassiere wanted something a little less hurtful, I guess, less cumbersome, more comfortable.
And who was she?
The inventor of the modern brassiere, the woman who got the patent, is Mary Phelps Jacob, who in later years was also known as Caress Crosby.
Yeah, she was a kind of a socialite, but became a pretty fascinating modernist. Tell us what this first bra actually looked like.
Well, basically what she did is she took two pieces of fabric and sewed them together in the center. So they were about 6 inches wide at the center, fully covering the breast, and she just added some ties that would go around the back and around the neck. The fabric was on the bias, so it created sort of a sling for breasts.
Well, I understand that her response from her friends was they were pretty shocked because she could actually move.
Yes, and be comfortable in it.
Well, it makes sense that the first bra might have been made by a woman, but the war effort actually helped displace the popular, though very constraining, corset. What was going on there?
Yeah, well, corsets were made with iron, steel, and so when the war came around, the war effort needed the steel to use for weaponry, shipbuilding, etc., and so women were actually encouraged to not buy corsets, and all that metal went into the war effort.
So when did the whole lettering, you know, the A, AA through D, happen?
That happened in the 30s. And it was a company called S.H. Camp & Company. And what they did is they correlated the women's breasts to letters of the alphabet, A through D. And then other companies started taking up this cup sizing and starting using multiple band sizes and the multiple hook and eye closure positions. So the 30s, we really see a lot of updates and more of the modern features of what we see now as the modern bra.
I found it interesting, Lynn, reading up on the history, that an item worn on a daily basis by so many women was influenced very powerfully by just a handful of men. I'm thinking of Howard Hughes as one and Frederick Mellinger of Fredericks of Hollywood. What did these two do, respectively?
Well, Fredericks of Hollywood, Frederick Mellinger was really an interesting gentleman. He started padding the bras and constructing them in such a way to push breasts up and together to create the cleavage.
Oh, the first Wonder Bra?
Yes, you could say that, yes. But it was a totally different look than what we had been seeing in, you know, the 20s, which were very flat, the 30s, a little more feminine, but the 40s, we really get that hourglass look. Mm-hmm. And Frederick's Mellinger really helped with that. And then we have Howard Hughes, who really helped lift the breasts, I guess is a good way of putting it. He really helped with the structure of the bra, and particularly for larger-breasted women, which were really, we didn't pay them much attention up until that time.
It's funny that this item that is, it's at once practical and highly symbolic. It's mundane and erotic. You know, it stood for women's oppression in 1968 when women started burning bras. There was, in 1969, an obituary written for the bra, which I guess was kind of premature.
Yes. I think the idea was interesting, and I think it certainly brought attention to the feminist movement. But it really is, I mean, the bra came out at one point as for health reasons, which I find interesting considering what they called as health reasons. So it wasn't looked at as a sexual garment that it was for these women who are burning their bras.
Well, what was the health argument for wearing a bra?
Oh, they had some of them were rather ridiculous, but they it would help you breathe better. It would help you take care of if flattening your breast was not considered good. I mean, we do know now that going without a bra will make your breast sag. So it's more of a visual than it is a health reason. But before, they were really talking about it, how bad it would be for your health not to wear a bra.
Any other significant moments in the bra's 100-year history come up for you, Lynn?
Well, I think we really need to thank the first jog bra, which was the first athletic bra for women, which really helped us participate in sports more comfortably.
And when did that come out?
That came out in the 90s, I believe. The Wonder Bra also came out a little bit earlier in the 70s.
Well, I can't help but think of Madonna wearing the Jean-Paul Gaultier, you know, those conical, almost rocket-looking bras on stage.
Well, that was really controversial at the time. And she was Madonna was really forward-thinking. She was the first woman to stop hiding bras and start wearing bras on stage and really emphasizing the breasts. I think of them as the boy toy bras because they were the men in her dance troupe wore them as well. And they were very long and conical and very out there and in your face, very forward at that time.
I have a wonderful Texan friend who says that her favorite moment of the day is when she takes her bra off. I mean, they're still not really comfortable. Where are we going from here on the design of the bra?
Well, actually, one of the reasons why they're uncomfortable is because most women don't wear the right bra size.
Boy, we've been hearing that for decades, haven't we?
Well, and our bra size changes. As we gain and lose weight, as we have children, as we age, our body changes. So we need to be fitted for a bra every few years. And you don't. It's not like, you know, I always wear a size such and such. No, you don't necessarily want to always wear the same size. You want to wear the size that's comfortable for you. They shouldn't be digging into your sides or into your shoulders. But we are seeing a lot of, Well, we're seeing it two different ways. One, there's this emergence of the past, 7 to 10 years of the little bralettes in tops.
Mm-hmm.
So the little tank tops that have like the shelf bra.
Right.
So I find that a fascinating development. And we also have some companies now. I know Victoria's Secret actually did a body scanning study on over 5,000 women to try to identify breast shapes, identify cup sizes, and how to better identify or enhance these sizes. Jockey International has just come out with a new bra fitting system that women do in their home, which is interesting. They send you a series of cups that you try on to see which cup fits your breast the best, and then the band is completely separate from it. So you can have a more customized fit to your body.
We've come a long way, baby.
Yes. Yes, we have.
Virginia Prescott there, speaking with Lynn Bourady, Associate Professor and Chair of Fashion and Textile Technology at SUNY Buffalo. If you'd like to see what some of the earliest bras looked like, including some pre-patent ones from the Middle Ages, we've created a slideshow on our website. It's very safe for work, and you can find it at wordofmouthradio.org. Thanks so much for joining us today. I'm Taylor Quimby, sitting in for Virginia Prescott. You can join us for more Word of Mouth tomorrow at 2 on New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by
Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters. Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.